Okay, it's 2 o'clock. Let's get started. What questions do people have? Come on, I know you've got questions.
Sorry?
Do I like the snow? Yes. I had a lovely time sledging yesterday. Do you like the snow? Any other questions? Do you guys like the demonstration? Have you been downstairs to the Occupied Lecture Theater? What are they demonstrating against? Who knows what they're demonstrating against?
Education cuts.
Education cuts, yes. In particular, trip in England, troubling of tuition fees. Not clear what's going to happen here yet. Trebling of tuition fees in Scotland would not be too bad, unless you're English, since Scots and members of the EU don't pay any tuition fees. But it's possible that they will introduce tuition fees up north, which would be an infinite percentage-wise increase. So if you haven't been downstairs, yes, do go downstairs and at least learn what they're demonstrating about, because it affects you directly. Any other questions? Okay. So, no Haskell programming this week, okay? That's not what the last week is about. Many classes don't have any lessons at all this week, but since I'm not talking about functional programming this week, I thought I would talk about other things that are important, like your life and what you're going to do with it. So, today's lecture is based on a very famous lecture about that topic. It's called You and Your Research. I'll say more about it in a minute. And then tomorrow's lecture is going to be on the pretty much the coolest idea I know. And it ties together everything you've learned in Informatics 1, both the computation and logic side of the course and the functional programming side of the course. And as I facetiously described it to you last year, it's why God wants you to learn Haskell. So I will try to explain what I mean by that and try to get you to help me clarify the way I ought to describe that. Right, so let's see, where are we? Did you know there's a final exam next week? I bet most of you were aware of that. You all have done the mock exam last week. This one problem that occurs again and again is there are always a few people that submit the wrong file. You think this is fairly straightforward. You have your answers in a file called exam.hs. That's the file you should submit. Some people manage, even though they get started with a file called exam.hs, to change the name of the file in which they're saving their answers and submit the wrong file. We have had files submitted that contain no Haskell code at all, but contain the output of running GHCI. How you do that, I'm not sure, but some ingenious students have managed to submit that instead of their answers. So it's fairly straightforward, but do please make sure when you're submitting your answer file that it is your answer file that you are submitting. Any questions about that? Yes. It's very difficult to mark. We actually have secret ways of monitoring your computer, and sometimes we can recover what you meant to submit, but please submit the right thing. Okay, and have you all seen the allocation of which room you're in? You should have had that by email. Anybody have questions about that? You're not nodding. Smiling. Right, if you don't know what room you're in, be sure to check with the ITO if you haven't had email about it. Okay, and if you're a special needs student, you get a little bit of extra time for the exam often, or other special conditions, and you'll have been contacted about that separately. Okay, so you and your research. So this was a talk delivered by Richard Hamming, who worked for a time at Bell Labs, and he came back to Bell Labs and delivered a talk there. I'm not sure if I have the exact date of the talk. No, I don't. But I actually worked at Bell Labs. So I sort of felt, I've sat in the lecture theater where he gave this lecture, and he's going to talk about the lunchroom. I've eaten many lunches in that lunchroom. But I didn't actually see this lecture, but I've read it. It's easily available on the web. I think we have a link to it now on the homepage, but if not, I'll make sure one is added, and you can just find it. So this was a lecture given by Richard Hamming. So he worked at Los Alamos, on the Manhattan Project. He then went to work at Bell Labs, and then he moved to the Naval Postgraduate School after that, for the end of his career. He was the third person to win the Turing Award. I've mentioned the Turing Award before. This is more or less the equivalent of the Nobel Prize for Computer Science. So he was the third winner of it. And he was the first winner of the IEEE Hamming Medal. It's not very often that there's an award named after you, which you're the first winner of. Right? That's quite an achievement. And that's a picture of Hamming, and that's a picture of the medal for the Hamming Award. So the point of this talk is how you can do research of Nobel Prize caliber, or Turing Award caliber, or Hamming Award caliber. And what I'm going to try to do for most but not all of this lecture is channel what Hamming had to say by reading out to you some quotes from this talk. Focusing on some of the bits that I think are most relevant. So first of all, many of you might think, well, that's not my goal in life, to win the Nobel Prize or whatever. And many of you perhaps are thinking that, well, it's not my goal in life because I don't think I can do it. So I want to tell you what he has to say about whether you can do it or not. And also, I know many of you won't go off and become researchers in universities, or at places like Bell Labs, which is what this is aimed at, but all of you will try to achieve things. And really what this is about is what it takes to achieve something. So I hope all of you will find this directly relevant and useful. And as usual, you should leap in if you have questions, although I'm not Hamming, so I'm not sure how much you want to trust my answers to these questions. So, you want to do Nobel Prize class research. What do you have to do? Say to yourself, yes, I would like to do first class work. Now, our society frowns on people who set out to do really good work. You're not supposed to. Luck is supposed to descend on you and you do great things by chance. Well, that's kind of a dumb thing to say. If you want to do first class work, just set out to do it. And then he gives some quotes from other people, right? You know, what about this thing that luck is supposed to descend on you? Well, Pasteur said, luck favors the prepared mind. Right? There are actually lots of psychological studies that show that there's a certain kind of person who is lucky. Right? Being lucky is not a matter of luck. It's being prepared to be lucky. And he also quoted Newton. If others would think as hard as I did, they would get similar results. So all you need to do is think as hard as Newton. Brains and courage. How about having lots of brains? That sounds good. Most of you in this room probably have more than enough brains to do first-class work. But great work is something else than mere brains. One of the characteristics of successful scientists is having courage. Once you get your courage up and believe that you can do important problems, then you can. If you think you can't, almost certainly you're not going to. So in other words, Hamming's trying to tell you, you can do it It's just a matter of believing you can do it and developing your courage and the other appropriate skills. And some of these are about the other appropriate skills. So this is something that Hamming has to say, and I've seen many other successful people say as well: turn a problem into an asset. When you're faced with something that you can't do, many other people can't do it as well. If you figure out how to do it, that will be useful. Early on, it became evident to me that Bell Labs was not going to give me the conventional acre of programming people to program computing machines in absolute binary. Right? This was back in 1946. This is what you did. You didn't have high-level languages. Fortran hadn't been invented yet, let alone Haskell. And you just program machines in machine language. Well, I finally said to myself, Hamming, you think that the machines can do practically everything. Why can't you make them write programs? What appeared to me at first as a defect forced me into automatic programming very early. Automatic programming was the old name for building compilers and designing programming languages. What appears to be a fault often, by a change of viewpoint, turns out to be one of the greatest assets you can have. As I've mentioned, it's not just Hamming who says this, right? You can find many great researchers or successful entrepreneurs who talk about how some difficulty forced them into the right direction. So you should always view a difficulty as God's way of giving you an opportunity. Right? There's a very standard way of expressing this, very anodyne. When life gives you lemons, make lemonade. Right? As with many anodyne things, it actually, there's a deep truth underlying it. This is a good one for you to learn now. Knowledge accumulates like compound interest. One day I discovered that John Tukey was slightly younger than I was. John was a genius, and I clearly was not. Well, I went storming into Baudet's office, Baudet was his manager, and said, how can anybody my age know as much as John Tukey does? He leaned back in his chair, put his hands behind his head, grinned slightly, and said, you'd be surprised, Hamming, how much you would know if you had worked as hard as he did for that many years. Well, I just slunk out of that office. What Baudet was saying was this: knowledge and productivity are like compound interest. Given two people of approximately the same ability, and one person who works 10% more than the other, the latter will more than twice outproduce the former. The more you know, the more you learn. It is very much like compound interest. I don't want to give you a rate, but it is a very high rate. So if you study 10% harder than the person next to you, and you keep working 10% harder than the person next to you for 10 years, that's more than twice what the person next to you is going to achieve. So you don't need to work twice as hard as the person next to you to do twice as well. Learn a little bit more every year, that accumulates. Because the more you know, the easier it is to absorb the next bit, and so on and so on. And when I first read this, I was a really old guy. I was really annoyed that I'd missed all those years that I could have been working that bit harder than everybody around me. You're the right age to hear this. I was not when I first heard this. What are the important problems? So there's this huge cafe at Bell Labs. It's 3 or 4 times the size of this room, maybe 10 times the size of this room. It's big. And they have all sorts of people there, right? The Nobel Prize winners in physics for discovering The Sound of the Big Bang worked at Bell Labs, as one example. The people who invented Unix worked at Bell Labs. One of them was my boss. And you know, all the chemists sit at one table, all the physicists sit at one table, and so on. Hamming started to eat at the chemistry table. And I started asking, what are the important problems in your field? And then after a week or two, what important problems are you working on? And then after some more time, I came in one day and said, if what you're doing is not one of the most important problems in your field, why are you doing it? I wasn't welcome after that. In the fall, Dave McCall stopped me in the hall and said, Hamming, that remark of yours got underneath my skin. I thought about it all summer. I haven't changed my research, but I think it was well worthwhile. I noticed a couple of months later he was made head of the department. I noticed the other day he was a member of the National Academy of Engineering. I've never again heard the names of any of the other fellows. So what is he saying here? He's saying, if you really want to get ahead in your field, do something that's really important to do. If you're going to be an entrepreneur, find something that needs doing that's very important, not that's going to affect a small fragment of the market. Find something that's central to what people need. If you're doing research in programming languages, tackle the most important issues in programming languages, which these days would be concurrency and distribution. This particular quote from Hamming has actually formed the center of a series of lectures organized by Alan Bundy, who's one of the professors here, called the Hamming Lectures, and which are precisely about people are forced to get up and say, what are the most important problems in their field? And oddly enough, they always pick whatever it is that they're working on. Develop reusable solutions. How do I obey Newton's rule? He said, if I've seen further than others, it is because I've stood on the shoulders of giants. These days, we stand on each other's feet. Has anybody heard that quote before? Who's heard the Newton quote before? Right, quite a few of you. Who's heard the Hamming quote before? This was about all I knew about Hamming before I read this talk. In fact, I read this talk because I was trying to track down the source of this quote. A famous quote about computer scientists, right? Newton talked about standing on the shoulders of giants. We as computer scientists tend more to stand on each other's feet. We redo everything time and time again, rather than just building on other people's work. The field has actually gotten much better about doing that. Right now, when you learn Haskell, right, I start telling you about the library, the standard prelude. When you learn Java, there's huge numbers of libraries, and you'll learn a bit about how to look things up and use those. It used to be people would always code up everything from scratch. So we've done better than that. But not as much better as we could do. Now, if you are much of a mathematician, you know that the effort to generalize often means that the solution is simple. I suggest that by altering the problem, by looking at the thing differently, you can make a great deal of difference in your final productivity, because you can either do it in such a fashion that people can indeed build on what you've done, or you can do it in such a fashion that the next person has to essentially duplicate what you have done. Try to make it so simple that people can absorb it and reuse it. And the effort of making it that simple is often extremely valuable in and of itself. It's often the case that people think, well, I shouldn't work to make it simple because then people won't believe I've actually done anything. It will seem too simple. It's better if I make it seem complicated. And if the person evaluating you is a bit of a dumbo, which can happen from time to time, then spouting lots of jargon and making it sound like you know a lot can be the way forward. But by and large, if you're doing something serious, the way forward is make it so simple that people can understand it and use it. The effort of making something simple is supremely worthwhile. And you will, in your life, if you stick with computer science, read many, many things that people have not bothered to make as simple as they should. Sell your work. I've now to come down to a topic which is very distasteful. It is not sufficient to do the job. You have to sell it. Selling to a scientist is an awkward thing to do. It's very ugly. You're not supposed to have to do it. The world is supposed to be waiting, and when you do something great, they should rush out and welcome it. But the fact is, everyone is busy with their own work. You must present it so well that they will set aside what they are doing, look at what you've done, read it, and come back and say, "Yes, that was good." If they don't stop and read it, you won't get the credit. Obviously, this ties in with making things simple. Part of making something easy to present well is to make it simple. And again, thinking about presenting things well is a very important part of what you're doing, regardless of what you're doing. If you're an academic, it's very important. If you're in business, it can be even more important. Okay, so that's the first half of the talk, what Hamming had to say. The second half of the talk is going to be my own advice of some things that I've bumped into that are useful. So I'll pause here. Say, are there any questions about Hamming's half of the talk? His half is obviously much more valuable than mine because he's much more successful than I am. Any questions? Come on. Any advice like Hamming's? So some other advice. So something that we've not dealt with very much at all in this course is the social aspects of computing. But there's an awful lot going on these days which is well worth paying attention to. Right? The notion of what is private and what is public is changing completely. The lecture that I'm giving right now used to be private, but there's a camera up there, and now it's a public lecture. As you'll know, many places that you go, there are cameras recording what you do. You'll all have heard stories of people that went out to some wild party, posted to Facebook a picture of themselves behaving rather inappropriately at that wild party, and then walked in to work on Monday to find that their boss had seen that picture and they no longer had a job. So the boundaries between what's private and what's public are changing enormously, and a major reason for that is the technology that you and I are involved with. So it's well worth thinking through those issues and what this is going to mean. A particular instance of this is identity cards. Britain still is at the point of not quite requiring identity cards, but the government has just backed down from doing that because it's so expensive, right? But most of you, who has a passport? Right, most of you have passports. That essentially is an identity card, right? In the US, what's used as an identity card is your social security number, and this is a complete disaster because very often if you want to prove who you are, you do it by giving your social security number. But your social security number is actually officially publicly available. So it becomes very easy for anybody to find your social security number and then prove that they are you. So for instance, if you're a student at a US university, 10 years ago, I think they've gotten a little bit more clever about it since, to identify yourself to receive your grades, you'd have to prove you were you by giving your social security number. But any student in your class that was very clever could easily prove themselves to be you. Okay, so that doesn't work. What does work? How do you make it easy to prove that you're you publicly without other people also being able to prove that they're you? But that's a fairly tricky question. We actually know good techniques based on cryptography for dealing with that sort of thing. How many people have heard of public key cryptography? Right, so quite a few know about relevant techniques. But nobody yet has made public key cryptography so simple that the government says, oh, we should use that instead of social security numbers. Right? So there's a lot of work to be done, not in research, but in terms of making the solution simple and selling the solution. The whole nature of computing is changing. People used to think that computing was about computing, algorithms, how you manipulate large amounts of data to get solutions. That's still, of course, very important, but now people understand that just as much it is about communication, how you move data from one place to another place. Right. How many of you have a phone with a GPS in it? Right, quite a few of you. How many have been walking someplace and suddenly received a text on the phone advertising a business near where you were? A couple of you that's happened to, right. Not so many yet. So they're very interesting issues, again, with what's released privately, with what's public, and with how computing is going to change as it goes from, you know, right. When I started working on computing, a computer was about as big as the room we're in now. And it was a large facility, and you would write your program on a punch deck and submit the deck of cards and have it run on the computer. And if you were lucky, you'd get back the answer the next day. I'm exaggerating. We'd get back the answer within an hour. Okay? Maybe 2 hours. I remember submitting punch decks like this and then running it, and 2 hours later being told there was a syntax error. Worked really hard to avoid syntax errors. And now it's different, right? You all carry computers in your pocket. So the whole nature of what computing means is completely changing, and we've seen huge changes in this. Things like the rise of social computing. But it's going to change much more. How many people saw the film The Social Network? There are a number of you. If you get a chance, see it. It's very interesting. Not necessarily true, because it's a movie, but interesting. Trust and reliability. How many of you have downloaded a program to run on your phone? Quite a few of you. How did you know that that wasn't a virus that was going to send your credit card details to Russia? You don't keep credit card details on your phone. Good, that's one step towards security. But of course, it could phone up a premium line for which you're charged. How do you know it's not going to do that? You didn't know. Did you trust where you're downloading the program from?
Not always.
Not always. Okay. So if you downloaded an untrusted program, did you take any steps to make sure it wasn't doing things that you didn't want it to do? Doing some monitoring on the phone, okay. But, right, lots of people will offer you programs. Sometimes those programs do things that you don't want them to do. Right. And there are many people that will, for instance, sell you virus detection software that, in fact, installs a virus on your computer deliberately. Right. There are lots of people doing scurrilous things out there. And how to control that is a very interesting question. So there are technical things you can do. Java has some features in it to control what the programs you download can do. People here are doing research so that you can control just using a type system like that, similar to that in Haskell, that you know that if a program is well typed, you also have a handle on how much memory it's going to use, say. Haskell doesn't do this, but advanced type systems can do that. And that's actually very important. How many of you have used a program on your computer, a game, say, that then ran out of memory on your phone? Right, quite a few of you. So this advanced work is quite interesting. And of course, you know, it can be much worse than your phone, right? It's getting to the point where you're downloading software to run on your car. You really want to make sure that that has certain safety properties. So one way of dealing with all this is some phone providers now say, we are going to control what can run on your phone, and we will certify to you that it is safe. Apple does this, for instance. The only way you can get a program to run on your iPhone is by downloading it from the Apple Store, and they supposedly vet all the code that is submitted. But of course, that means you can only get something that's been vetted by Apple. For your laptop, you can download code from anywhere, and you decide. And right, there are lots of things that Apple has decided, oh, that's not appropriate, but you can get it from elsewhere. At one point, Apple decided for the iPhone and the iPad that you needed to use a limited number of programming languages. This is because they were in a fight with Acrobat, which manufactured a different programming language. So they just said, nope, you have to use one of ours. And anything else is illegal. So for instance, there's a kid's programming language called Scratch, which just lets you manipulate graphics around and build computer games very easily. And it's mainly aimed at young children. And they said, nope, we're going to disable the iPhone app for Scratch, because only Apple programs are allowed. Now, they back down on that, but there's still this real choice between some phone systems like the Android, they're committed to being open and saying anybody can download programs on this, whereas Apple has said, no, we're going to have very strict control over this. And I think it'll be very interesting to see where that one goes. It's quite likely that Apple will win, and everything will move towards this very strictly controlled. All the big phone companies, right? I mentioned Android is open. Well, if you buy your Android from some phone companies, it's not open, because they've decided, no, we want to have control over what runs on this phone. If you imagine what it would be like if computers were like that, and you could only run something if it had been approved by one of the big companies, well, would Haskell ever have been approved? Probably not. When it started, it was just a tiny research project. So how would we ever have gotten ground if for anything to be used on a computer, it had to first be approved by some large company? Right? And there are huge numbers of things that all of you use on the internet. What would you have done if that could only appear if it had been approved by some large company? And of course, if you can only get things through the Apple Store, then they can make some money when you do so, indeed. And lots of people teach you here how to make an app for Apple that you can sell through the iStore and make money, right? Many people have adopted that as a great business model. But there are very complex issues going on here. And people wanted to have control over this thing precisely because of issues like how they make money from it. And what this is going to do to openness of innovation is unclear. Right? But the companies that are out to make lots of money, even though they could make much more money from innovation, might not see that clearly. And so innovation may well be cut off in various ways. There's lots of talk about making some bits of the internet more accessible if people pay more money. And then it might be that the internet becomes mainly something for people that have lots of money, rather than have many, many small websites that gradually over time become popular. So it's going to be very interesting to see how this develops. And you will all, I think, have a large role to play into what extent things are controlled and to what extent there's innovation. And you can tell that I'm sort of in favor of the innovation side rather than the control side. But I hope I've also explained that there's, in fact, arguments on both sides. It'll be very interesting to see how things work out in the long term. Yes?
Isn't this in conflict with the democracy principle of free speech?
Is this limitation in conflict with free speech? Absolutely. But nobody yet, I think, has sued the iStar on the grounds that it is in violation of the constitutional amendment for free speech. And one reason for that, of course, is that the iPhone is considered a private platform, not a public platform. So all these things are, in fact, widely used publicly, but they're not legally public platforms, so the companies can do with them what they will. Right? You're entitled to free speech, but that doesn't mean the newspaper has to publish what you say. Yes? If you don't have good legal backup, you won't win. That's certainly true if you're bringing a law case against a very large firm. Okay. If you want to keep track of some of these issues, here's some resources for you. There's an organization called Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility. You can just type in CPSR to Google, and they will locate it for you. And they keep track of many of these things. They're a good authoritative source for information on this. One thing I didn't mention here, which CPSR has looked at a lot, is vetting voting machines. Right? Voting now is often done by a machine through software. That raises questions about, well, how do you know that the vote that's returned has been the correct vote? And they keep track of things like that. If you're interested in unusual ways computer systems can go wrong, there's the forum on risks to the public in computers and related systems, moderated by Peter Neumann. And again, if you just type risks to the public, I think, well, certainly if you say in computers or if you say Neumann, you can find it very quickly, but there's the URL. And again, there's very, if you want to keep track of what unusual things are happening in the world of security and risk with computers, that's an excellent resource. I began the course by mentioning this quote, so it's good to come back to it at the end. In their capacity as a tool, computers will be but a ripple on the surface of our culture. In their capacity as an intellectual challenge, they are without precedent in the cultural history of mankind. Another quote from him is, computer science is no more about computers than astronomy is about telescopes. Right? What's good about the telescope is what it lets you see, the stars. What's good about computers is, well, all the computation they can do is absolutely wonderful, just like looking at a star is absolutely wonderful. But the real point here is that you can apply computational principles to solve problems, right? One of my favorite examples of that is there are lots of people who work here on programming languages, and what their programming language is about is writing a program that simulates what happens in a cell. So they're trying to understand the complex interactions between chains of proteins in a cell. It turns out a good way to describe and understand that is by writing a program that captures what's going on there. So we'll find, another related example is keeping track of what's going on in the cells now depends on monitoring and making available huge amounts of data, right? The obvious example of this being the Human Genome Project. But there are many, many, many databases now that keep track of different kinds of proteins and what they do. So what happens in informatics and what happens in biology are in many ways becoming very closely intertwined. And that's just one field, right? The same thing, right? Telescopes and stars were mentioned here. Astronomical databases are absolutely key to doing astronomy now. All sorts of subjects are behaving very differently because of the impact of computers and networking have upon them. Another thing, again, which we're expert in here, computer understanding and translation of natural language. That used to be very hard. Now we're developing huge databases which make it much more tractable. Right? The Google work on automatic translation is a good example of that. So there are very different ways of doing research in all subjects now. And then finally, I want to talk about a couple of things much more general than computing. One is simply time management, right? You're all going to have to do a lot in your lives. You can do much more if you use your time effectively. There are lots of courses or sources of information on how to do that. I suggest you avail yourself of one of them. Something that I found useful is the book Getting Things Done by David Allen. But there are just lots of different sources. Pay some attention to it. Use a little bit of your time to learn how to use the rest of your time more effectively. There's also reference there to one particular blog post on fixed schedule productivity that I found very interesting. Somebody who managed to write a huge number of papers while still a research student and while very carefully only working 8 hours a day. And the other thing I want to stress is communication skills. Just being able to write clearly and lucidly is perhaps the most important skill you can have. There's a wee little book, it costs, I think, £6, called The Elements of Style by Strunk and White. Doesn't cost much, it's a thin book, doesn't take long to read, but it will teach you possibly, it could be the best investment you make in your life, right? Because for £6 and for a couple of hours reading it, you could suddenly learn how to write clear English. There are many other books that do this. Another one that's been recommended to me recently, but I've not actually had a chance to look at it, is Lessons in Clarity and Grace by Williams and Golem. There's another one, which I didn't write down here, called The Complete Plain Words, which is also well-respected by Gowers. How many people have read any of these books? Anybody read Strunk and White? I have. Anybody read Lessons in Clarity and Grace? How can you not read something called Lessons in Clarity and Grace? So either these books or something else, but just learn how to write English well. And then the other thing you want to learn how to do well is present information graphically. So Time Life made a list of the 100 best books of the last century, and one of them is The Visual Display of Quantitative Information by Edward Tufte, who, by the way, got rich just because instead of getting a publisher to publish the book, he published it himself. It became a classic and sold enough copies that he had spare money, which he would use to do things like go off and buy an original copy of Newton's Principia Mathematica. And then I actually had the pleasure of taking one of the courses in communication skills that he teaches, and he passed this book around the room. So I've touched Principia Mathematica, thanks to Tufte. So this is a book, half of it is about how awful a lot of what you read in media presentations of graphs and so on is, and half of it is how to do a good job yourself. And then this book was so popular that he wrote four more. Oops, I only have two of them listed here. One is Envisioning Information. Another is Visual Explanations, and the last one in the series now is Beautiful Evidence, which also contains some information on how to design computer interfaces. So, and they are all absolutely lovely books to read. So I highly recommend going down to the library and checking these out and having a look at them. And then finally, don't just keep your heads buried down reading technical books. Read some well-written fiction. It doesn't matter what. But if you read something that's really well-written, the cadences will enter your head. And you will have some idea of how you should be writing when you write something. So anytime, right, you might, so the next time you find something really good to read and somebody says, hey, why are you goofing off reading that really good book? You could say, no, 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 this is very good for my development. My professor told me so. I strongly urge you to just expose yourself to anything, right? good writing is good, but basically expose yourself to anything that's well done and use that as an inspiration so you can do well yourself. Now, the last thing that I want to point out is that you are living at the perfect time. If you're really interested in physics, now is not a great time for you, right? Because Newton and Galileo and Kepler already happened a long time ago. They pick what is called the low-lying fruit. Computing is just at its very beginning. We've had our Turing. We haven't had much else. There are a few names that I would recognize as being wonderfully significant. Robin Milner, who used to be a professor here, immediately comes to mind. But in terms of what the public is aware of, in terms of really serious impact on the science of the world, Turing has had an impact, and very few others have yet. There's just an enormous amount to discover about what it is that computers are and can do, and how to organize that, how to make it simple enough that other scientists can, and technologists can use it, and of course, selling that. Don't fool yourself, right? All of Galileo, Newton, and Kepler knew how to make things simple enough that other people could use it, and they knew how to pay attention to selling it. So, in the world of computing, all that stuff is yet to be discovered. I'm absolutely certain that 500 years from now, Bill Gates will be remembered a little bit, but the people who are going to be most remembered are Turing and the people that made similar contributions. And those contributions of weight and value, apart from Turing's, they're going to be made by your generation. So you've picked exactly the right subject at the right time. I applaud your choice. Go out and do it. Thanks very much. Any questions? Right. See you tomorrow. Tomorrow we'll be giving away the competition awards, among other things. So looking forward to seeing you all.